Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Build to Billions podcast, where we guide successful entrepreneurs and investors on their journey from millions to billions. We believe that the key to scaling and compounding your wealth starts every single day with the mindset and practice of stewardship over ownership and applying billionaire biblical principles. Each and every episode, we have some of the world's top entrepreneurs and millionaires and billionaires on the show, where they share their expertise and wisdom with us so we can level up our business, our faith, our success, and our impact. I'm excited about our next guest. He is out of Carmel, Indiana. And you can, however you want to pronounce that, but it's Indiana. It's not the Pebble Beach one. And he's actually the founder and CEO of BAM Companies, a private equity asset management and fund management. He has over 26 plus years of experience. And he has successfully raised over $700 million in equity, acquired over 9,000 units, equating to over $1.7 billion in transaction volume and so much more. And today we're going to be talking about one of the most challenging things that a lot of operators and syndicators are coming across, which is basically unlocking capital. It's been a challenge, to say the least, in the last year. And we're going to talk about that with Ivan. Please welcome to the show, Ivan Barrett. Ivan, how are we doing?
Brett, it is so fun to be here, man. Happy Monday here. What is it? February 3rd, 2025. Happy New Year, man.
Happy New Year. It's coming fast and furious, right? With the new administration in office taking action and things moving quickly in a lot of different directions. But it seems to be a positive momentum moving this direction. But I'm curious, before we get started into the topic at hand, which is, you know, raising capital in today's environment, what give us a little bit more about your background and your journey to where you're at. I mean, I would say I wouldn't start maybe necessarily from the zero, but maybe from the once you guys had, you know, 100 million raised, right? Like this show is more like from there to there, yeah, to scale it, right? Versus the zero.
I'll skip the birth. Yeah. So I've been in real estate for a very long time. Hung out a shingle in 2010, starting property management first, because I wanted to build the execution machine early before getting too big. And frankly, I didn't know better. I didn't know you could skip all that and just go out and do big deals. So I went the property management route first. We're about $1.7 billion transactions under the belt, like you said. Starting from 100 million. So I think that's a great place to start. You know, right around there, we stopped doing third-party property management. We don't lend our team out to anyone anymore but ourselves. And we've really come a long way since asking the question, what if we had a property management company where people liked their job? And I've had some great people on board who believe in that vision, taking care of our biggest stakeholder first, which is our employees. We've come a long way there from culture. And what that has done is it doesn't generate a lot of profit at the property management level, but it's created this machine, this beautiful machine of humans who execute for my wealth strategy and our investors. And so now we are managing, oh gosh, about 6,500 units plus or minus. We've had 14 exits, some really strong IRR and equity multiples. And for the third time in my career, Brett, we are in the midst of a pretty deep correction in real estate.
Okay, a couple highlights here, right? You said you focus like a laser on the one big premise in the thesis, which is, what if we had a property management company where the team members love their job, right? Yeah. So I think there's so much to unpack there. You know, I'm originally from Texas, and I moved out to Florida here a couple of years ago. But property management and, you know, the toilets, the trash, the tenants, the termites, right? For a traditional landlord is the biggest, you know, challenge, right? The biggest challenge, or finding quality property management, or being that property manager, and staying and being able to create a community. So what, you know, you said employees first. So break down those secrets. What does that mean? And how did you measure if they love their position?
Yeah, it really comes down to mindset. Now, how we measure that today is we have an internal employee NPS score. We have an external one for our investors. We have something similar for our residents. We don't call them tenants anymore, Brett. There are residents that live in communities. But we have, we internally measure that. We work really hard at culture. We stay true to our core values, which we figured out very early. They're not aspirational. I love asking questions to my audience of family, of our employees at our all hands annual event, where we fly in everyone from every asset we own. We bring them into Indy or Carmel, as you said, for a couple of days of learning and connection and fun. And I love asking them how many people came from a property management company where the resident experience was part of the core value. A lot of hands go up. Here at BAM, we focus on the employee simply because, yes, we want the residents to have a great experience, Brett. We want them to write good reviews and stay maybe a year or two. And so we work really hard on that. But the people who stay much longer than a resident, on average 12, maybe 24 months, are the employees that work for us, the family. And so we are a loyal, loving family. We treat them well. We believe that BAM grows when people grow. We've got a fun, quirky kind of spirit around here. If you're too buttoned up or tight-laced, you're probably not going to fit in. And I'm forgetting one of them. Loyal, loving family. When people grow, BAM grows. Fun, quirky spirit. Oh, yeah. Work hard, play hard, win. That's us. Those are the core values. We didn't make those up or aspire to be those. That's just who we are, and that's who we hire. That's who we bring on board. If you don't meet those core values, you're probably not going to last here very long. I spoke earlier, you know, we don't make a lot of profit at the property management level. What profit we do make goes back into culture. Blowout Christmas party every year. Note, I did not say holiday party. I said Christmas party. That annual conference I mentioned, quarterly events, and old school corporate style all hands barbecue family reunion every summer, where we fly everybody in again. And culture's not cheap, but it is what makes the difference in the execution. And a funny thing happens, man. We get people that do a great job and tend to stick around a while. BAM started in 2010. This year we celebrated 3 10-year anniversaries, two of which were maintenance guys, which I am incredibly proud. And I think next year we've got 5 or 6 more celebrating a 10-year anniversary with us, which is like a lifetime in property management. And every year, the amount of 5-year BAM-iversaries that we celebrate continues to rise.
Okay, I'm already having fun just talking with you. So I can already tell it'd be fun to be a team member with you guys and gals. So this is amazing. So I want to focus on a couple things. You know, I've been studying this. I don't know if I'm studying this or heard this, but I'm trying to practice. This is a better way to put it, okay? I'm practicing this, right? A, you've always got to be, it's called an elf. You know, in fact, I'm watching Lord of the Rings again with my children. And we're going to start reading the books together.
I'll go there. Let's go.
And so they go to the elves, you know, and the elves. And so I heard a good, cool way to describe elves. And not necessarily the Lord of the Rings elves, but yeah, you could say that. But elves versus haves. Have you heard this saying? Elves versus haves. Haves, okay? So you got elves. Easygoing, loving, fun, right? And you typically can know that within about, you know, maybe 30 seconds to 3 minutes of spending something with somebody, right? Easygoing, loving, fun. And the other side is haves, right? And these are the challenging things. And these are the things we're going to practice, make sure we're not ourselves, but right? Hard, annoying, lame, and frustrating, right?
I love it. I love it, man.
Okay. And so there's L's and haves, and, you know, can we all get grumpy sometimes and things happen where, and you got to ask yourself, am I being hard? Am I being annoying? Am I being lame? Am I being frustrating? It's the self-awareness piece of it. But the most of the time, I'm easygoing, I'm loving, and I'm fun. And I want to attract that type of energy. I want to be that to other people. And I want to grow. It doesn't mean you don't have excellence. It doesn't mean you don't push really hard. But overall, are you going to have a positive, you know, resilient, solve the problem in this together mindset, right? Or is it going to be really hard, annoying, lame, frustrating, right? And so those two things. So I love what you said, family, loyal, loving, fun. I think about the L's versus the haves. Number two, you said BAM grows when people grow, right? I think there's a quote by John Maxwell, as a leader gets better, everyone gets better, right? And everything rises and falls on leadership, right? So talk about that. So you're at 100 million and you're like, man, we're going to get to 1 billion. That's our number. I want to scale it. You've established obviously some core values. What was the next key thing? You're living the core values. You're putting the employees first. You're pouring into the culture for the team members. Walk us through anything else that you want to cover that you can reflect on that Wow, that was definitely a game changer from 100 million to a billion.
Yeah, sure. I mean, we did things like EOS for a while, right? We brought in that entrepreneur operating system. We also had to let little bad things happen, right? If people are going to grow, they have to make mistakes. It's not going to be a straight line up the mountain. Those are just two things that came to mind when you asked about what else. And I'll double down on that. Growing from 100 million of assets to a billion, there's a lot of pain along the way. There's a lot of heartache and stress and getting hit in the mouth and getting knocked down and having to get back up again. We typically have to really stay true to the course. We've had people that go through that revolving door and don't make it. We've outgrown people. We've had to bring in people from the outside. But the elf part of the answer, or the positive part of the answer, is we've had these folks that have been with us for a long time that have continued to learn and grow and step up into new roles. Great example, my chief of staff has been with me a long time. She came up through the accounting department, but had a real good sense of culture and project management, and she took the proverbial baton very early. I'm lucky I have an operating partner, the yin to my yang. If I'm the visionary, he's the integrator. And the more I got out of his way and let him keep the trains running on time and manage the operations and the day-to-day, the better it went, and it freed me up to do what I should be doing, what I'm good at. One of those other 10-year anniversaries that I spoke of earlier, a young guy named Ryan came to work for us right out of college. He's now running most of the asset management responsibilities. He's had almost every job in that property management side of the business, and now he's looking at it from a higher perch. But he's been down in the trenches and knows what it takes to win at the property level.
Okay, so you mentioned three key people. I want to first focus on the first one. You said chief of staff, right? She had an excellent sense in project management and culture and accounting, right? Wow, that sounds like a dynamic individual right there to have those three things. I think creativity and EQ for the culture part, but also the detail, right? Like that's a great combination there. So was that groomed? Did you help to groom and build that into her? Or, how was that someone who was with you for, you sound like, a long time, right? So, yeah.
The great thing about a person like that is she's going to go out and grow herself. She's going to, she went and got her MBA from a prestigious school. When we started thinking about this chief of staff role, she went out and read the book on what it takes to be a great chief of staff. Mm-hmm. And what I found is that the greatest people figure out their own path to learning and growth. They're the ones inside their own head. If they can really be intentional about it, they're going to do far better than I could.
Got it. Okay. So she's very intentional and did that and hungry, personally driven to do that. Awesome. You mentioned the second, you said the second thing was yourself. You had to learn to get out of your own, out of the integrator's way, right? And let the integrator integrate and trains on time. Like, walk us through that transition period, right? Because that's hard for the visionary, right? I mean, he's you and the scenario or the visionary's listening, like they built the thing and mostly that. They were both for a while until maybe they brought the other person in, and then they had to figure that out. So, any kind of wisdom there as you learn to let go and or as you learn to ebb and flow and work together in that transition.
Absolutely, I meet a lot of entrepreneurs, a lot of visionaries, and many of them cannot get out of their own way. It's the old saying, "Know thyself." And when I started looking inward and really focusing in on what I should be doing with my time and what I suck at and finding the who, right, not the what, to help me in those areas that I shouldn't be meddling in, the better I become at what I need to be doing, using my gifts, and the better the organization becomes as its own organism, which has got all these little parts. But together, the whole is worth more than the sum of those parts if it's done well. And I still run across lots of visionaries that I ask them, hey, are you a visionary or are you an integrator? And the common answer is, well, I'm both. I can do both really, really well. And that's actually their Achilles heel to ultimate growth. It's not being able to get out of the way, not being able to drop the ego and find their other half.
Okay, I love that. So it starts with realizing your strengths, your weaknesses, and doing an assessment of that and being humble enough to say, yeah, here's things I'm not great at. I'm horrible at it. I'm awful at it. And let that other person jump in and have that compliment. Was this person that someone you found and hired? Was this someone that was from the beginning, or how did that all come about?
Yeah, I started the company in 2010, and my partner and I will celebrate our 10th year of working together this June. So he came on board about 2015. Multifamily broker, very smart guy. I could tell he was the brains of the operation, analytical mindset. But really thought we were just going to do apartment deals together and we'd have to find a third person to run the management. Well, that third person didn't materialize and I was sucking wind on my first syndication, a small 60-unit deal. And I said to my partner, Adam, listen, I know this is a good deal. I think it's just me that's screwing it up and I haven't figured out quite how to run this yet because I was jumping from 15, 30, 35 units to 60. And he got his hands on it and got it humming and running way better. And unfortunately for him, I realized those skill sets and just kept giving him more management responsibility after that. And within a year or so, I think he became basically the de facto COO of the company. And of course, now it's official and he has been for many, many years. And, you know, I'll say this here on your show. Aside from my spouse, he's probably the second best blessing of my real estate career.
Oh, that's such a great, great story and connection, how you brought that all together. So he was analytical brain, multifamily broker. You're in the middle of a deal. And you're like, what's going on? Like something is, for whatever reason, not working. It should be working. You're humble enough to say, basically take over this or start leading this deal. He starts to lead the deal, run the deal, or manage the deal, whatever all those things are. And then you're like, oh, wow, it doesn't have to be that difficult. I think sometimes the visionary thinks you've got to grit through the things that you're not good at, right? And somehow figure it out and solve
early.
The problem.
You do early, Brett, for sure, right? I mean, I had to wear all the hats when I started the company, but eventually what got me here won't get me to where I want to go next.
Right.
And, you know, by myself, I can go really fast. But if I want to go far, I've got to bring people with me.
Yes, exactly. And great. And by the way, we're speaking with Ivan Barrett. Barrett, B-R-R-R. ATT, right?
Yeah, it looks like Barrett. It throws everybody off.
Yeah, BAM Capital, everybody.
It's easier to Google, though, if you spell the name right.
Okay. Yeah, awesome. So now I know we promised what we're going to be talking on, right? So now let's shift. That's a great intro, great background, and I think people got value for that for sure from growing their companies. So now let's shift into the topic at hand, which is, you know, raising capital in today's environment. I mean, this last year, you know, I always said that, you know, I felt like capital was oxygen and everyone was, you know, starving for air last year, right? They tell us what the challenge is for those that are looking to raise, what it was in 2024, what's your senses for 2025. And you know, and then we'll start to dive into some ideas to unlock the capital versus raise it.
So just a little bit of a setup here. So this is the third correction of my career. So the first one, GFC, had a front row seat. I was working for a couple of developers as an in-house broker, basically. And so learned a lot. And coming out of that, Brett, I was able to start using hard money, private loans, to basically burr multifamily. So two units, three units, then six, then 30. Get a hard money loan and basically get enough capital to buy it, heavily renovate it, right? Rent it, refinance it, and repeat. And those deals did incredibly well because there was less capital available than, and there was lots of deals. However, as a percentage rate, I killed it, but I was still a small operator. I just started the management company, and these were, again, two units, three units type of multifamily. The next correction that came was very short. It was the first two quarters of COVID. Institutions stopped getting on planes to come to Indianapolis and tour institutional assets. Everybody thought it was going to be 2008 2.0 in the early days of lockdown. The bears thought, this is it, buy your gold, buy your ammunition, we're toast. We were able to scrape together $45 million in our first fund, and we've absolutely freaking crushed it with the assets that we bought during that first fund, during that small, tight correction. Now we're in the third correction for different reasons. We had the fastest velocity of interest rate increases in Federal Reserve history, which has created another deep correction in real estate. And in a nutshell, we've been able to put $200 million out the door. We've had to use a lot of our own capital, me and Adam. We've had to use a lot of our own capital to close deals and continue to raise after the fact. Because, again, we are in a period where there are lots of opportunities if you know where to look. And I know a lot of sponsors are saying, oh, there's no opportunities, the bid-ask gap, and all these things are preventing them. But what's really preventing most sponsors from putting deals together is the lack of equity. And we experienced a lot of the same thing. We found that a lot of our LPs are exhausted. They haven't had the realizations in other deals. I can't tell you how many times I've heard, hey, Ivan, we'd love to reallocate more to BAM, but we just don't have any dry powder. It's all been put to work. And some of those are saying, hey, we wish we had put it to work with you. It's to work with other sponsors. There's cap calls. They don't know what's going to happen in the deals they bought in the Southwest, the Southeast, Texas, Florida. And so there's a lot of fear in the marketplace. And everybody can say, Brett, hey, when people are fearful, be greedy, right? But it's just not that easy. A lot of people don't have the capital, and that's why the deals are so good. So luckily, we've worked really hard on filling up our pipeline of new potential investors, working with some bigger investors that have more capital to put to work. And again, my partner and I have used a lot of our own capital, tens of millions of dollars to get to the closing table, to scrape enough together. Over the last 24 months, we've put well over $200 million out the door, and we've capitalized about $600 million of real estate, mostly in our fourth fund. We've still got about, $17 million left to raise there to backfill, but those were all bought at the bottom. And then we've also been helping and joint venturing with developers who have really great projects in areas that are going to need supply in a couple of years, but they don't have the equity to get it done. And we've been able to come in and partner with them and offer those opportunities to our growing base of investors, which has surpassed 1,500 LPs.
Okay, awesome. All right, let me bring that all back to...
Bring it back.
Bring it back here. Okay, so A, understanding that each market cycle or downturn is going to be a little bit different challenges, right? 2008, yep. The main thing was deals were available, but it was difficult to get debt. So you went and you said, hey, I'll do hard money financing and I'll buy a deal, restructure it, refinance it, and then go do more and more and more and more.
I was really lucky. Big blessing. I got introduced to my first private lender, and they were really good guys. And they were not loan to own guys. They wanted their borrowers to pay them back. Got a great relationship. I was the first guy to come in their office with a PowerPoint on what I wanted to do.
Yeah,
I had just read Dave Lindahl's Multifamily Millions or Apartment House Riches or something. And I'd also read this hard money formula. And so I put the two together to start buying multifamily.
Love it. There it is. Yeah. And then COVID hits and then you don't back off. So you double down. And
Oh my gosh, man. Yeah. I was on the phone with literally every investor in our Rolodex to scrape together $45 million.
$45 million to buy the deals. And then, obviously that was great because things just, so everything went well. Things rapidly appreciated, made the fastest, one of the fastest appreciating markets.
Occupancies went nuts. Yeah. Kept raising rents and people would choke it down, 10-15% increases. They just kept coming. Yep.
Then now this next one is lack of equity, right? But now this is the neat part. You position you and Adam yourselves to put in more, right? So you led and say, look, we're putting in more and more and more, and you're still putting it together. So you have those that are out there listening that have funds or have syndications, and they're either their LPs are tired, right? And they don't have a lot of dry powder, And so now it's like, well, what did you do? Well, A, fill up your pipeline with investors. Number one, you never stopped doing that. You probably had systems in place. And
well, and that's not cheap. That's not cheap. It was all paid advertising. So the really fortunate part was we had a lot of liquidity that we were able to access when others couldn't.
Okay. So paid.
And, you know, hats off to my banking relationship here in Indiana, Merchants Bank of Indiana, you multifamily operators out there, because they won't take you if you're just a capital allocator, but if you're a true operator, Bank of Indiana's best partner on the planet.
There it is. Now on to that piece, and you said advertising. So do you have a CMO? What does that look like? You know, when did you start doing ads? You know, is it, you know, mostly LinkedIn, Facebook, Instagram, like what you Google SEO, like walk us through a little bit of that strategy, Ivan.
We really stepped on the gas in 2023. We've been doing it, but we stepped on the gas, really upped the amount of capital spent on Google, YouTube, Facebook, a little bit of LinkedIn, all across the board, and continually are tracking that that cost to acquire a customer, where the customers are coming from, to fill in that top of the funnel and introduce ourselves to more potential investors.
Quickly, what's the best ROI for? Is it YouTube? Is it Google?
None of your business, Brett.
He's like, that's how we've got it. All right. Fair enough.
Figure it out on your own, guys.
But no. Do you have someone?
Seriously though, man, it can change. It can change. Yeah. It can be Facebook for a while, then Facebook kind of goes dead, and you're on Google AdWords, and I think YouTube isn't going anywhere. That's for sure.
Do you have like the focus though on the CMO and like the do you have someone that's all they do is basically just running all of the marketing and all of the ads, like that's their focus exclusively?
Oh yeah, big marketing team. Our vice president of marketing at the top, she's got a great team underneath her. They help me with these videos. We got the studio here, right?
How did you know when to hire that? How did you know when to hire that person? Like, was it just like, okay, we're at 200 million, we're at 100 million, we're at, you know, was there like a piece, or you're like, okay, let's just go for it? Like, how did you know?
Well, a couple things there. I love that you're asking this question. So since the beginning, I've told my people that we are not a small business. We are a big, big business that today happens to be small. A lot of my decision making is based on where I want to be a year from now, 2 years from now, 5, 10 years from now. Who's my next big hire, right? Who's the slowest hiker? Where are we weak? Where do we need to get better? And so I'm constantly thinking about who to hire next that we may not need today to support the current going of the business, that'll help us get to where we want to go tomorrow. That's a big part of it. And you know, I can't say that like I can predict things or have a crystal ball, but I just had this sinking feeling when things were getting really hot, that some point down the road, we would have a more difficult time raising capital and that we would need to put these measures in place. And so that was the catalyst to saying, okay, how are we going to start increasing the funnel size at the top? I can't talk to every investor. I love doing it, but I can't talk to everybody one-on-one anymore. How do we get more distribution out there, right? And then also, you know, making sure that I would have liquidity when the time came. That is certainly embedded in my DNA from, again, having a front row seat to 2008 at a young age when, it was humbling, formative, a huge blessing to my career. I was an egotistical real estate cowboy, big hat, no cattle back in 2008, and thankfully learned a lot and was able to recover and start this thing we call BAM.
You know, I love that you learned during the 2008. I mean, you really grew up there in a sense and got you started there. Anyone who made it in that marketplace, I feel like can make it in any marketplace, especially if they made it in real estate.
Hanging on by a thread, but we got through it.
Yeah, and you got through it. And it really shows your focus and your resilience. By the way, everyone, you can learn more about BAM Capital by going to BAMCapital.com. It's BAMCapital.com. So here's a thought. Now let's talk about other ways to unlock capital right now. Okay. Yeah. So I'm going to throw out to you, that the big mistake people are making, Ivan, as they're looking to raise capital versus unlock capital, kind of like you just said, we're a big business that happens to be small. I think the mindset shift for people is, hey, we're trying to raise the capital for this particular deal or this particular fund within this time frame, within this, you know, cost seg bonus depreciation, with this cash on cash, with this IRR or this value add. Like it's very, very focused on the closed once the money's there. That means you're raising for that particular idea, the particular fund, the particular IRR, or if it's a debt fund, you know, here's the cash on cash, here's the 30, 60 or 90 day liquidity opportunities and, you know, those kind of things. Okay.
Yeah.
Here's my premise. Don't raise capital, unlock it. Okay. Unlock it means you go and you add value in a way that's going to easily help the funds to flow into your fund. Now, here's how we've been able to do this. We do it through focusing on the biggest pain point that the high net worth investor has before they show up with these millions of dollars to invest with you. And what is that? We have found when they're selling their business, their Bitcoin, their real estate, their stock, it's capital gains tax. In fact, 50% of all the wealth in America is tied to high-end primary homes, businesses, and commercial real estate, most of which is owned by baby boomers, of which every single day, 10,000 are turning 65 in the U.S. alone. And there's about 80 million in the U.S. alone. And they represent between $84 and $100 trillion worth of net worth that's going to pass over the next 15 years.
You got my ears perked up, Brett.
Yep.
So let's unlock some capital gains.
Yeah. So this is the question, right? How do you unlock capital gains to multiply freedom and impact? And it's even more than just let's focus on just the returns, right? And let's focus on the ROEs and all. It's actually not so much the traditional ROIs, it's the return on impact. And so by focusing the conversation from not just financial wealth, but family mission, vision, values, legacy, freedom, and impact, right? Combined it with the number one reason why financially they're not likely to sell or they're not likely to show up with the capital, or at least if they're going to show up, it's going to cost them 20 to 50% of their proceeds. And because that's the key here, like if you sell, no matter where you sell, no matter what you're selling, it's somewhere between 20 to 50% of your gains is going to be taxed with capital gains tax, right? Okay.
Sure. Depending on what state you're in. Yeah.
Yeah, depending on your state, you're depending on depreciation recapture, depending of, you know, we did like a land deal in Texas that was a, you know, $8 million exit for a client, but it was a double sale, right? Where they tied up the land under contract and they did a double close. They didn't hold it for a year, so it didn't qualify for long-term capital gains. It would have been ordinary income tax. So we can do it for that, like on these big, big exits. It's okay. So that's the key, right? So we say around here, it's not just about cash flow. It's about tax flow, okay? And more than that, it's capital gains tax flow, right? And so if you focus like a laser on that piece of it and the stats are behind it, you start to unlock for people what we call truly passive income. And so we believe our premise for 2025, the number one way and mindset to have to help to unlock capital and not raise it is to think truly passive income, to think mission, vision, values for these families, and then to use the tactic, which is deferring capital gains tax to flow right into your fund. In fact, this is how our good friend we were talking about, Mr. Don, with his company, we've been able to bring in, you know, tens of millions of dollars over a short period of time, as clients, because they want to see two things. They want to see a good plan to help solve the tax challenge, defer it, and yep. Then a great plan to be able to, where's the capital going to land? And when you can combine those two, it's like, it unlocks. It's no longer raising because they say, oh my gosh, bam, you're going to return. And we'll talk, maybe we can talk about a little bit of the returns here in a second. X plus Y. What is the way to do that in a very, very efficient way beyond just the internal, the time frame? External would be the unlock. Any questions or thoughts on that? I'm just curious what you would think about that.
No, I'm excited to learn more. Especially with the what you said earlier about folks that want to sell stock, right, and get more hard assets, which I think is probably a great strategy. We're seeing the wealthiest families in the country increase their allocation to private equity real estate by as much as, total 20, 30, in some cases more. Across all privates, you're seeing a lot more capital flows into privates. It's starting to get down to the retail investor. But I think there is a big obstacle there. Selling those assets come with a tax bill. And so if you've got a great, I don't want to say mousetrap because that might give the wrong connotation to folks, but if you've got a great system we're getting through that tax efficiently. My team wants to know more.
Absolutely. If people want to learn more about that, you can go to capitalgainstaxsolutions.com. You can download the free ebook there, 9 steps to basically creating an amazing smart exit plan. And you can also buy the book, Building a Capital Gains Tax Exit Plan. We have Kevin Harrington from Shark Tank. It actually hit bestseller for Amazon, which is pretty cool. And it's a chance for you.
That's awesome.
Thank you. Thank you. Unlock your capital gains tax when you're exiting highly appreciated assets. Got to get started today. Go to capitalgainstaxsolutions.com. We also have the best 1031 exit plan, Ivan. Let me talk about this one a little bit real fast. A lot of people, they go on these 1031s and they probably call you and say, Ivan, can I 1031 exchange into your fund? And you answer?
Right now, no.
Yeah. So what if there was a best 1031 plan where you could say, no, but go for your 1031. And if it fails, you can land into a capital gains tax deferral strategy, which turns around and can go right into your fund.
Well, I was listening to some of your earlier episodes to prepare for this one. And yeah, when we're offline, I want to hear more about it or what you've got now. Go for it. I mean, it's your show. You call the shots, Brett.
Well, I think it's valuable to go back and forth because what we found is a lot of folks, they just don't know, or they don't know what they don't know. They're kind of sometimes in the box, right? So I think the visionaries, we can see outside the box a bit. Now, this strategy has been going around for close to 30 years, you know, thousands of transactions, been through all the audits. But I don't know, Adam, what brokerage he was at. I was at Marcus and Millichap, and I learned about this in 2008.
I was just reading Barbarians at the Gate, which is the story of, the leveraged buyout, hostile takeover of Nabisco. And one of the buyers was trying to use a DST to get it done there.
Like, yeah.
It's not new.
Yeah. And so, and by the way, sometimes people get it confused with the Delaware Statutory Trust.
No, we're not talking about that. Good point. We should tell them.
So there's two DSTs. And sometimes people, like what you think you know can hurt,
I got it now, right? Deferred Sales Trust.
Sales Trust, yeah. That is this versus the Delaware Statutory Trust. Good. And so the Delaware is just a 1031 exchange. Okay. You can do that. It's like a structured 1031 exchange. To a passive deals, it can be plural, right? Typically 10-year holds, 7 to 10-year holds, large corporations, it's a security, right? They're packaged, they're non-recourse. We actually use those to solve debt over basis. We use the Amazon coupon zero, it's called a zero coupon deal where it has a large 85% LTV. And we're using it to solve what's called debt over basis issues for folks who have done the cash out refis. So they have a place for them for sure. Okay. So that's where we use them. But the rest of it goes into the deferred sales trust. So this kind of brings it together. The best 1031 exit plan, you can do both. And so you put partial 1031, partial Delaware, and then you can do the rest of it into the deferred sales trust. So I'll give you an example. We have a client. He's selling some land in Texas. Okay.
Can I ask you to do an example? Because I've got this coming up.
Yeah, let's go.
We've got some single assets that are outside of our funds. They're deals we did 5, 6, 7 years ago.
Yeah.
They would have sold except for the correction, so we've been holding them. Mm-hmm. So when we do sell these in 2025, they're going to come with a very sizable gain for our investors. But we might not have something to 1031 into right away. You know, maybe we're between allocations in a fund. Mm-hmm. I think I heard you mention on an episode that there's something you would recommend there with your system on the deferred sales trust, right?
Yep. Yeah. Yeah. So the answer is yes. We could set up, like, for example, an individual a trust that does just a business with IBM, except one up for Adam and other GPs and the other LPs that have larger gains. We could do it for as well. That's one solution.
Let's say there was 30 LPs in an apartment. Would they all go into one singular trust?
That's the neat part, right? Because one of the biggest challenges for commercial real estate syndications is that typically the LPs, they all have different interests. Some of them need the capital now. Some of them don't need the capital now. So most of the commercial syndications we work with, they don't 1031 for that exact reason, because typically the whole entity must move. And that's why 1031 is like Blockbuster, meaning everybody must go typically. Okay. So I'll give you an example. I have a client, David and Jordan. They own over 3,000 units and they do multifamily syndications. They haven't done a fund model yet. And they said they've never done a 1031 for that reason. And so what we did is we just carved out their individual GP positions. And it doesn't force the other LPs to go and commingle into the next deal or that trust, right? So it can be individual one. And so second thing on that is if there were 30 and they all had at least $1 million gain and $1 million net proceeds, then they also could use it. Everyone could do it. So the LPs or GPs.
Right. You need about $1 million proceeds for this to really make sense.
That's what we found to make sense. Now, if they had two 500 each, Ivan, then they could do it. If they had 500 and 500, like two LP positions on two of your projects, then we can combine it into one. And then the neat part of that is they might be looking for some more cash flow, and you might have a debt fund that's paying more cash flow. And then so instead of having to stay equity to equity where it's maybe not as high of a cash flow, and they don't necessarily need or want the bigger upside, they're like, I'm actually good. We've got our proceeds. We've got our gains. Let's defer it. Let's put all of that to work. And we'll give you an example of that. We had a client, we just did an $8 million deal out of Massachusetts, okay? It was an automotive sale. So it doesn't even qualify for a 1031. Zero basis. We deferred about $2.5 million of tax. Put all of the funds into the trust. They have about $2 million that they held back, so about six or so hit the trust. And then we immediately turned around and we deployed it mostly into debt opportunities, right? Yep. One of them paying 16%, one of them paying 10%, and then we also diversified into some apartment complexes, right?
So I can take my stock gain, I can take the sale of my business, I can put it in that trust, and then that trust basically invests in the debt vehicle.
You nailed it, right? And so so for them, they were on a truly passive income. So like they made their millions and on their gains, they didn't necessarily, and not that they don't want to also make that, but they want to unlock cash flow. So a lot of these business owners, they're business rich or they're real estate rich, but they're cash flow light, right? Or their time and their energy is just being consumed by this, right? And so because they're just in it all day in management or real estate, right? So now we shift that and we say, let's unlock the capital, but what's really, it's unlock truly passive income. And so we define truly passive income as peace of mind, right? And basically more time, right? And when you unlock those two, it frees up the margin to spend more time on the family mission, vision, values, whether you have kids or whatever it is meaningful for you to make an impact for you in this season of life. And that's the key. Like the 1031 typically keeps you in the same type of, frequency of your time and your energy. But if you can get out of that, it's transformational for people. They go, oh, I always wanted this passive, income, but I don't have it with my current, time and my energy.
It makes a lot of sense.
So you combine all of the amazingness of a fund like you guys. You have multiple funds, I imagine, right? Multiple deals.
Oh, yeah.
Back to answer your question. So you can exit those apartment complexes. You can use all or part of your position. You can defer all the tax. Then you could turn around and just put it right into your own fund. All tax deferred, right? Cool. The LPs can do it as well. The other LPs can just pay their tax, the ones that are smaller ones. That's basically the name of the game. Now, if Trump brings back the bonus depreciation 100%, which we think he's probably likely to happen.
Likely.
That's also cool too, right? Because then you might have some real estate deals or your funds are going to be producing maybe some cost seg bonus depreciation. So we'd also balance it with both of those things. But bringing the full picture together, your current investor base has businesses that do not qualify for 1031, and they have Bitcoin. We did a $5 million Bitcoin exit for a client. She had 50,000 of Bitcoin and went to 50 million. By the way, now that's worth over 100 million. But when it was at 50 million, we exited 5 million tax deferred, and she was able to put it into a business startup. And it's been great.
Out of the 50 million, only 5 million is deferrable.
Yeah. So no. So let me clarify. So she bought Bitcoin for 50,000. The value sprung to 50 million. She sold 5 of that million into the trust, and the other 45 she held on to.
Okay.
Kind of a cool story. Listen to this. She worked for Google. Really, really smart. But more than that, it's like a ice cold veins to be able to hold on, right?
Diamond hands, Brett. That's what we say. Diamond hands.
Certainty of conviction. Okay. So Bitcoin went from 54,000 when we sold at 5 million to 68. It dropped all the way to $15,000. She held the entire time. Okay. Now on the 5 million, we were already exit. We were already diversified. She was using that to start the capital. But then when the market, now we're over like 100,000 a coin. So she's over $100 million net worth. Okay. And so we're going to exit probably another couple million, this year in a way to diversify. But the point of this is, there are those in your current 15 accredited investors who have the primary home, who have the business, who have the Apple stock, who have the Bitcoin, that are millions and millions and millions of gains, that they're waiting to unlock it to help have more residents, not have affordable housing, right? Have attainable workforce housing. They can make that impact with you guys to have the passive, diversified, durable cash flow. Like, it's all there, right? And so that's I appreciate you letting me dig into this part of the episode.
Totally, man. I smell a private webinar for our investors to learn more about some of these strategies.
Yeah, absolutely. So enough of all about that. You go to capitalgainstaxes.com and bamcapital.com to connect with both of us. Let's move into the lightning round. You ready, Ivan?
Ooh, lightning round. Let's go.
All right. Knowing what you know now, if you could go back to your 20-year-old self, what's the one golden nugget make sure to tell yourself to do?
I knew you were going to ask me that question, and I'm going to flip the script a little bit because I can't do that. But what I can do, Brett, is I can ask my 10-year older self. I can imagine being 56, right? And now all three of my kids who are 13, 11, and 9 right now are all 10 years older. What did you do or stop doing or didn't do that you regret? And what are you going to do today that you're going to be proud of 10 years from now? What are you going to focus on to make impact in those little humans' lives? How am I going to look back the next 10 years and say I did well at marriage, I did well in my faith, my kids, my fitness, my fun, my impact in the community, and of course with BAM. But those are BAM and business is at the bottom of that list. If I screw up with those other things at the top, it doesn't matter how much money I have in the bank or how well BAM does. And so I was thinking, I knew this question was coming because I snuck into some former episodes, but I'm looking at what I can do from here in the next 10 years.
I love it. So really it's, you would ask yourself and you're asking yourself, what are your perfect life numbers in 10 years that would make sure if you achieve those numbers, you'd have no regrets in the next 10 years?
Yeah. What do I need to stop doing today? Who do I need to stop hanging out with? What do I need to cut out of my life? What got me here that's not going to get me to where I want to go next?
Perfect. Awesome. I love the wisdom. I might just switch my question moving forward. Like, that's a great point, you know? Number one question. Question number two. What's the number one book you recommend or gifted most in the past year?
Oh, gosh. So I've been on a biography, autobiography kick now for about a year. And gosh, the favorite of all of them over the last year, the title might throw some people off on this show, but it's called The Gambler. And it is the biography of Kirk Kerkorian. Amazing, inspiring story. A man that did so much, started from nothing, page-turning story, and did it with a huge, huge, strong integrity, great reputation for fair dealings, made huge deals in aviation, gaming, entertainment, movies, the list goes on. And they had to do all this research because he was a guy that no one really knew about and would stay out of the limelight. And it was just a man of big integrity and did a lot of big things. And it's worth the read for especially any aspiring entrepreneurs out there that might be listening.
Awesome. You could check that one out for sure. Question number three, what are you most curious about right now?
Ooh, that's easy. AI.
Yeah.
You know, I don't think AI is going to cause any job loss, but I think it's going to amplify the people we have and change the way we do business. I've been starting to just experiment with it on my own. And, I think it's going to be as big as the internet, maybe bigger.
I agree. Can't agree more. Next question. Number one leadership quote or theme that you strive to live by?
Ooh, number one leadership quote or theme. I did not prepare for that one. The first thing that comes to mind is extreme ownership and really looking inward first when things go wrong or my kids are misbehaving or, you know, my marriage is in a tough spot. Trying to do my best to look inward and not blame outward. And, I've been much better at leading teams by really example and with my kids too, right? It's monkey see, monkey do. So trying to be a really good example and stepping out of the way of really great managers, people that are way better than me at leading the day to day has been a game changer for our growth.
Ivan, it's been more than a pleasure. It's been informative. It's been inspiring. It's been fun. You're definitely an elf right? And I love that. And you're also driving to make an impact to help with the attainable workforce housing crisis. And so you're making a big impact, and you're doing it for your team, you're doing it for your family, you're doing it for these listeners, and you did it for me today. So from me to all of our listeners, I'm going to thank you. I want to encourage you to keep using your gifts and talents to make a huge impact. Do not slow down. Do not hesitate, and keep pushing to make a big, big difference for everybody out there. For our listeners who want to get in touch with you, could you remind them one last time what's the best place for them to find you?
BAMcapital.com. Brett, thank you so much for having me on. This has been truly a lot of fun, man, and looking forward to many more conversations with you in the future.
Absolutely. And for our listeners, I want to thank you all for listening to another episode of the Build It to Billions podcast. We're also streaming on Capital Gains Tax Solutions YouTube channel and podcast as well. So if you're hearing us there, we appreciate all the listeners out there. We want to encourage you to take some action today, take the inspiration today, and go take one big thing that can change your life and can make a big difference in your business or with your family. Lots of wisdom here in today's episode as well. If you're going to exit a highly appreciated asset, you want to pick up the book, Building a Capital Gains Tax Exit Plan. Take your time to go to capitalgainstaxsolutions.com and prepare, because you need to prepare before the exit to make this all work for you. Appreciate everyone listening, watching out there. We will talk to you all again real soon. Bye now.